Hello everyone, David Coulthard here, DC to the loyal anchors who have been listening to the show through 2023. The following show was recorded before the sad news of the passing of a good friend, Gilles de Ferran, on the 29th of December. Next week, Eddie and I will be paying tribute to the great man. And until then, I hope 2024 has started well for you all, and I wish you health and happiness in the coming year. Hello and welcome to Formula for Success. I'm David Coulthard, and alongside me virtually once again is the one and only Eddie Jordan.
Wow, DC, I just thought that maybe my luck had changed for the new year and I might be rid of you, but you're still there. But anyway, David, this is great. And starting a new year like the way it is, so we've got lots of things to talk about.
We have indeed. So very quickly, Happy New Year, EJ. And second of all, how was the motherland? Did it treat you well? Because you were in Dublin.
There's something about Irish Guinness. There's something about Irish pubs. There's something about folklore and lyrics and poets. Everyone was talking about Fairy Tale of New York and Shane McGowan and Sinead O'Connor and singing their songs on Grafton Street. And everyone was rejoicing the fact that we actually were all part of their success because they were very good artists, David. They felt the people. Some rock stars can move in and move out, but these were different things. Dublin is able to embrace great literary people. All down the years, we've had some great poets and very, very good authors and writers, screenplay actors and stuff like that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Incredible. You guys have the gift of the gab, I think is the expression. Today on this episode, we're going to be talking about, you know, great team pairings and the sort of wingmen that have stood out through either our days of when we were fans of the sport or whether when we were active in the sport. But before I go there, on the music, I mean, you talk about your Shane McGowans and all these, you know, incredible, you know, Irish artists that have been over time. Their names, individual names, stand out. But of course, they're only as good as the team of people behind them, because if the music's not played well or it's not arranged well, because presumably they're the lyricists and they're the vocal cords that bring it to life, but they don't do it all on their own. So why do we sometimes focus on the individual name of the star and we don't highlight the group or the band behind them?
But is that not the way it happens? When you go to the movies, you'll see the name of the leading actor. It'll be Liam Neeson, or it'll be this guy, or whoever. And that's what draws the people to the crowd. If you go and want to see the Rolling Stones, you want to see Mick Jagger, don't you? I mean, does anyone know who's the new drummer of the Rolling Stones anymore? People may remember Charlie Watts, who was an absolute legend and a genius, but that's only because I'm a bit of a fan. Whereas it is the front man. I mean, you talk of U2. The band is owned by Larry Mullen, and he was the guy who put it together. He put the ad up in the school to say, look, I'm forming a band. If anyone wants to come and think about joining me, come and join me. So it's always been his band. But, you know, when you talk about U2, you think about Bono, don't you? Or maybe The Edge every now and again. But the rhythm section gets, you know, that's why I quite like playing the drums, because it's the rhythm sections. We usually pale into insignificance.
Okay. Well, then bringing it to our world where our careers met and merged and we were operational, motor racing and the great team pairings. And I guess also to that point, when you think of, you know, I think of Michael Schumacher's great success at Ferrari. Is it Michael Schumacher we give the credit to, or do we give the credit to Ferrari? But I guess the answer is that he was alongside Eddie Irvine and Rubens Barrichello and Felipe Massa for most of that time. And although Felipe came close to winning a title, not when Michael was there, none of the teammates you really, really remember. So we put the focus on the individual, you're absolutely right, rather than the team. So if I look back through the great team pairings of history, I guess when I first started to really pay attention to Formula One, would have been around the sort of Piquet Mantle, was that 87, then into Prost Senna. You know, I guess that was more explosive as team pairings go. But that's where my earliest memories go. What do you think stands out, or certainly in your mind, what were one of the fiery or great team pairings that you can remember through the history of the sport?
Well, I think the Prost-Senna will probably go down as the number one because they were so brilliantly talented. Prost winning 4 world titles, of course, Senna winning a whole heap of titles too. And they were unbelievably quick. I want to come back to the thing. You mentioned Michael Schumacher and Barrichello and Irvine. I was involved in those contracts with Ferrari. I remember sitting in Lugano trying to beat my brains out, trying to get the lawyers to agree to what I was trying to say, which was non-productive. And they were trying to tell me that we had to move over for Michael, but yet they didn't want to pay us the points money for moving over. I'm saying, no, I won't agree to that. And you can't have them. We're not going to drive here. And so eventually they agreed, which I thought was a massive coup, to give the same points bonus money to Eddie as what Michael had got. So therefore there would be no differences between the two, and Eddie would therefore wouldn't be grateful for giving up the place, but at least he wasn't losing money by doing it. 99, you should know that your teammate Häkkinen was involved in what was a three-way battle for the title, and it was Irvine, Häkkinen, and to a lesser extent Frentzen in our car, but Frentzen leading the race in Nürburgring. Had he won that race when he switched the wrong buttons. I mean, honestly, how he turned that car off, I just thought, oh no, he had 20 seconds of a lead. Anyway, the fact is he didn't win the race. So therefore, we went to Suzuka, not having the chance to win the championship. But Michael had come back from the accident, and you were quite accurate, but not quite on the money when you said that these guys didn't win the championships when Michael wasn't there. Michael did come back and told everyone that he was coming back to help Eddie Irvine win the championship. He did not do that. He did everything that he could because he didn't want Ferrari to win a championship with a driver other than him. That's what I believe, and that's what Irvine believes. And, you know, the statistics, and when you look at the way he handled the race in Suzuka, he did nothing to help Eddie. Whereas I think Häkkinen was the champion, you were his teammate, and everyone was happy because I think he was probably the deserved champion. I think Michael was always a difficult teammate because no one really, even though he had Massa, as you rightly say, and Rubens Barrichello and Irvine, he had all great, great wingmen, but they all knew what the score was. And I never liked that, I have to tell you.
Well, I guess one guy that we didn't mention there who was also a teammate is our friend Martin Brundle. And that was really at the beginning of Michael's Formula One established career at Benetton. And, you know, Martin ran him hard on a number of events. And I think that once Michael sort of learned from Martin's experience, he then sort of upped the ante and, you know, made it difficult for Martin to sort of flourish within the team, and probably was instrumental in helping him no longer be with the team. He was pretty good at handling threats, wasn't he, Michael?
Look, you talk about one of my favourite drivers. Remember that in our Formula 3 day, I went to great lengths to sign Martin Brundle. I thought he had real style, real character and real speed. And he was incredibly unlucky in a way, because who wants to come up in their maiden year in Formula 3 up against the great Dickie Bennett and Ayrton Senna? I mean, that's formidable from both sides. But to his credit, Martin, once he got his head around it and once we got a car working, and I think Silverstone was the kicking point, we had Yokohama tyres, we decided to run under the European Championship rather than the British, and Martin went and won it. I think Ayrton was a little bit fragile. He was unbelievably talented, unbelievably quick, but a touch fragile in the head once you got into it, and I did the most incredible amount of things to screw him up. I mean, not letting him out to test because he had hadn't paid them money and doing all sorts. And I really got under his skin, even though I loved the guy. But, you know, my commitment was for Martin Brundle. And it went to the very last race in Thruxton. There was a point between the two of them. And fair play to Ayrton. He won that race. We were second. And he became the champion. Then that followed into Formula One. And then who does he team up with? You know, Michael Schumacher. I mean, you can't get much better than that in those eras than Senna and Schumacher. So I think Martin Brundle was dealt in some ways a difficult hand, because he was always up against by far the biggest favourites and the biggest champions that there were at the time.
Yeah, no question. Martin went up against future champions, and of course went on to win his own world championships in sports cars, where he really seemed to flourish. What do you think about how we'll look back on, because it's still relatively fresh, isn't it? The Mark Webber, Sebastian Vettel, well, I guess we're going back to 2008, 2012, but still seems fresh in my mind. They had quite a, you know, explosive relationship, that famous Malaysian race where the call was given for them to bring it home in formation, and then only for Seb to overtake. I think we spoke about it actually on the podcast with Adrian Newey.
Multi-21. I wanted to know exactly what it meant. But then there was the big accident, if you remember, was that Turkey? Yeah, the two of them ran into each other. I mean, that must have driven the team and Christians. That was mad. And then Silverstone, when he was, you know, the great thing, Mark is not very shy when he needs to be out there. And at Silverstone, he was out there and he says, "Not bad for a number two driver." And I think he took over your seat, or could be wrong.
No, well, Mark was there when I was there for a couple of years, and then Seb Vettel came from Toro Rosso, and took over when I retired. But when you actually look through the history of the sport, you know, you had, was it Pironi and Villeneuve? They were an explosive partnership at Ferrari. They fell out, and then I think it was it the following race? Sadly, Gilles Villeneuve lost his life in Zolder. There's never really been what you could call amicable teammates when they've both been, let's say, evenly matched. When they've both had a chance of winning Grand Prix, it tends to get a little bit spicy.
Are you making reference to the fact, because on the basis of what you just said, I'd like to know what is your particular position about you and Mika Häkkinen? Are you saying that he was much better than you, or are you saying you are much better than him? Could you enlarge on that there, David? Because I'm confused. I don't know whether you're stroking yourself there or you're stroking him.
Neither. But look, there's opinions and there's facts. And the facts would show Mika was a two-time world champion, which I was not. So Mika was a better all-round Grand Prix driver than I was. But we had our moments of going wheel to wheel, and we had our fallouts. And I think that's the point, really, the whole thing about trying to discuss the big driver pairings. They tend to be really the biggest management challenge that the team principal, the team owner has, when you've got two drivers that really have a chance of going for victories. So who were the two drivers that you had throughout your tenure as a team owner that you were difficult to manage because they were both at each other's throats?
Well, I would have to say somebody who now lives in Cape Town, and we had dinner with Adrian the other night, and that's Ralph Schumacher and Jarno Trulli. My God, I was so upset with that.
Was he cracking jokes all the time, Ralph? Because, you know, a German joke is no laughing matter normally.
Oh, come on, David, give them a break. He makes bloody great better wine than you and I would make, that's for sure. And his hospitality is quite simply staggering. He's a lovely guy. I'll not have a bad word said about Ralph Schumacher. I think he's a real
He's a lovely guy. I like Ralph very much.
Are you sure? Are you being genuine here?
Did he crack you any one-liners?
How will I change the subject here quickly? But anyway, the reality is that Jarno and he, despite me shouting and roaring at them in, I think it was one of the few races that we went to in Argentina, which I loved, by the way. It was a great place. Believe it or not, Gary Anderson always said that the 97 car was better than the 98 car. The 97 car was particularly strong. And I get the impression that Jarno was in second place, but wasn't prepared to give it up for Ralph because he was much quicker. And they came to the hairpin and they ran into each other. I went absolutely ballistic. If you can't imagine, anywhere as a censor of any country, even the most liberal censor in the world would have censored what I said. I was so vicious with them. I told them that they were two total wankers and that they didn't deserve to be in a car, and I was going to sack them when I got them back out. I'd calmed down then afterwards, but I never saw the funny side of that, because in my opinion, they cost us in 1-2. I know you go on about races that you should or could have won, David, and I've always been supportive of what you said, but this is one occasion that it was taken away from the two drivers. And
did they crash out?
Ralph finished third in the end. Ralph did finish third, which was some salvation from the end, but it was very poor.
Oh, my God. Well, look, I didn't recall that race, and I'm very sorry, but I can imagine. I can only imagine, because I've never seen you that angry, but I've seen you angry, and I can imagine you were off the scale there.
We had never won a Grand Prix at this stage, and we just recently, the previous year, we'd had the pole position with Ralph and with Rubens in Spa, and we could feel that the things were turning slightly in our favour, and it was a matter of getting sponsors, and Benson and Hedges came on board, and we had a decent chance of getting money from the Deutsche Post and various other things. And I felt really good about the team, and we thought we had some brilliant young engineers, and so for them to crash like that was just sinful. I felt there was a very low regard for the team in itself. And I sat them down. I reminded them. I made them sit for a week while they repaired the cars in the garage, in the factory in Silverstone. I made sure they came to England, and they had to put in the same amount of hours and times as the mechanics did, because I wanted them to see the pain that they had put on the rest of the team. Not talking about the financial stress or pain, but, you know, just the aggravation that they put the team through unnecessarily.
Well, when you talk about teammates coming together, you know, I had couple of comings together with Mika during my time. He spun me around in Estoril in Portugal, 1996, and there's a photograph of me giving him the bird as I'm facing the wrong way as he passes me. So it was always my quick reactions and frustration. I had a coming together with him in Austria. I think that was in was that 99 when I spun him around, and then unfortunately didn't win the Grand Prix, finished second, which caused a lot of despair within the team. And then we touched briefly at the first corner on Spa, which I then went on to win the race. But other than that, what do teammates coming together? Prost and Senna, of course, famously in Suzuka. They then came together in Suzuka when Prost was at Ferrari. What you've had your teammates come together. What other big battles can you remember where teammates have basically ran into each other?
You know, the Patrese situation when he was with Mansell. Patrese on his day was incredibly quick, but, you know, Mansell was the darling of Britain, and he could do no wrong as far as the media were concerned, and poor old Ricardo was such a nice gentleman. And but the battle I remember was obviously the Prost-Mansell days coming down the straight. That was epic when they touched each other. But look, talking about teammates, it's become a big scientific purge at the moment to know exactly what the teams are going to do and your teammates going to do. And I think motor racing is a particularly good example of that, because David, you would have known what Häkkinen was likely to do. And when Dayton comes up to this kind of level of racing, you will be telling him, you need to study what your teammate is likely to do and where he's going to go. Will he go for the inside of the corner mostly, or will he stay on the outside? Just small little things that you are prepared mentally to, on the laws of average, what he's likely to do, and then you are well prepared for it.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Some drivers, you know, will not give an inch. And some drivers are actually very, let's say, fair. Once you've sort of presented your car and you've got enough of it on the inside, they realise the bigger picture is to lose as least amount of time getting past, and then either, you know, try and come back at you or just accept that's the way it is. Some drivers will fight it to the point where you both end up losing time, and then your overall race time is affected. You're going to still get past them. And that's what I never understand when some drivers are being lapped, for instance. The best way to be lapped is just to lift slightly on the straight and allow the car to overtake you. It's not to drive offline in a slower corner, picking up dust in your tires. It makes it very difficult for the car that's overtaking you to really commit to the corner, because they can't possibly know what you're thinking. And two, as I said, you end up just messing your tires. So I think there's an overall vision of how to run your fastest race, because that ultimately is the best race, is however you get from lights out to checker flag and the path of least resistance. Some guys seem more drawn to incidents and accidents than others. And, you know, those guys, I guess, are expensive for you to have in the team. So is an example of a driver from the Jordan days that brilliantly fast, but was a bit wayward when it came to wheel-to-wheel action, and the crash damage was quite high for you.
Well, he has since gone on to win the Indianapolis Indy 500 twice, and that's Takumo Sato. If the car came back in with four wheels on it at any given session, it was a miracle. He was quick, but he never knew why. And we didn't know why either, I have to tell you. Oh, Jesus, even talking about it, he's the loveliest man on this planet.
He's a lovely guy.
Jesus, never have him in one of my cars again, please. Oh, my God. He crashed at every given moment. But such a nice person. You could never be angry with him, because so apologetic and so kind and generous and giving presents to the staff and to Marie and me. I said, fuck the presents, just drive the fucking car, will you, man? Stay on the road. And he couldn't do that.
He is a lovely man. I'll absolutely say that. But there's a number of drivers that get a reputation of being a bit of a crashers. You know, Andrea, the crasherist, the Cesarist, who sadly is no longer with us. You know, I think that Grosjean, in his early career in Formula
One,
got involved in more than his fair share of incidents. You know, we saw it last year. Somebody's put together a little stat of all the accident damage, and I think poor Logan Sargeant was up there as one of the more expensive drivers. Yeah, I had plenty of crashes myself. I'm not trying to hide from that. But there are those that seem to be very good, very good, very good. Oh, no, it's all gone wrong.
You had the difference. You didn't always crash, but you caused a lot of crashes. I mean, I'm still on my knees thanking you, but I'm not going to pay you. I mean, Spa, you wiped out the whole grid at the start, blaming poor Eddie Irvine, and then you decided to take on Schumacher. But what you have is an unbelievable ability.
I'm not sure poor Eddie Irvine's the correct description. Very wealthy Eddie Irvine.
And rightly so, because he's a genius. But you have the ability of always, I never saw any other driver getting away with that. When you had a crash, most drivers... listeners, you will see them, they're in the car and they're shaking their head and then they take their helmet off. DC never took his helmet off for fear someone will come out of the bushes and punch him, because he caused so many accidents. He realised that someone was going to shoot him or kill him or punch the head off him. So he decided the best way out of this is leave me helmet on.
Well, the truth is, actually, I couldn't afford a custom-fit helmet. So with this shape of square head, by the time the helmet went on, it took two people to get it off. I couldn't get it off myself. Let's move on to some listeners' questions, I think. So there's one here, Ethan Ford.
Yeah, but before you answer that, please, David, I've got to stop you, because tell me, people talking about, there's a lot of situations where tire management is becoming so goddamn boring for the punters watching it on the television. Do you think it's possibly now the time to bring some competition to the actual manufacturers? So we remember when Goodyear were there, and then we had the Bridgestone, and then we had different other manufacturers, and Michelin, of course. And I'm just thinking, do you think the Pirelli have done such a remarkable job that it might be good for them that another competitor be introduced?
Competition improves the breed. Competition improves us as human beings. Competition improves goods and services. Competition improves racing. So there is no doubt in my mind that everything would get a little bit better if there was competition. Now, Pirelli have done a fantastic job of delivering what's been asked of them in terms of where we were with the previous tyres, coming with the bigger tyres, And there you go. They win every Grand Prix. When Paul Hembry was there, I'd go and shake his hand and say congratulations on winning the world title at the very first race of the season, because that's the only people that know they're going to win the championship because they're providing the tyres. So no doubt it would get better. But the argument that we'd put forward would be that it would increase operational costs in having two manufacturers. And that's factual in as much that you'd have two groups of tyre technicians travelling around the world with all of their tyres. It would mean, I guess, potentially that there wouldn't be quite so much revenue from the advertising that Pirelli have around the track, although I can't assume that, or can't presume that it would be impossible for both tyre manufacturers to advertise in the same way that you've got Mercedes safety cars and then you've got Aston Martin safety cars. But I just don't think there's a desire right now to have a tyre competition, but I think it would be better. And you know the other thing it would do? Sometimes it would be Pirelli that had the right tyre for the circuit, and sometimes, let's say for argument's sake, it was Bridgestone, would have the right tyre. So you would naturally have this, you know, competitive shift circuit to circuit based on the only thing that touches the ground, which is the tyres.
One thing as a team principal, I must tell you, David, because I was there in this type of era when there were different manufacturers, and the main manufacturer being whoever, we say a Michelin, it would go for the Renault team and it would go for this. And they would pick the teams that they thought could win the championship, naturally enough. And they would pay them accordingly because there would be a very significant budget there. And I don't know how you would get the competition in there without having the free fall of the big money. And I just don't know what's going to happen. So maybe we should just leave that particular question. Incidentally, that came from Alan in Dublin. So Alan, thank you very much. And Dublin is rocking at the moment. So well done to you. So DC, there was another question there. If you were a team principal of Coulthard Formula One team, and you've decided that you have free choice of everyone except Max, what two drivers would you go for?
Well, I put Lewis Hamilton in there for sure, as someone that is just a winning machine when things are, you know, when the vehicle is below him. And I think if money wasn't an issue and all that sort of thing, I would do one of two things. If this is fantasy Formula One, I'd put Fernando alongside him just to see when we asked the questions about the great rivalries. They didn't really get along when they were teammates back in the McLaren day the first time, but how would it be now? One's, 38, 39 in the case of Lewis, and the other's 42. But if it wasn't someone like a Fernando, I'd go for a young, developing rookie to learn off of Lewis for the future. So that could be an Oscar, it could be a Lando, it could be a George, Charles. They're all great drivers.
And again, Stephen, thanks for the question. But I'm a huge fan of Leclerc, and I'll probably have him in there for sure. Lewis would be very hard to overlook, that's for certain. Time, years are not necessarily in his favour, but I'd be sort of thinking of further down the road, so therefore I wouldn't have Alonso in there and I wouldn't have Lewis necessarily. And I think, you know, I have a real soft spot for Albon. I just think that given the right situations, that I think he could really, really be mustered. And I would like to see at some stage that he given the chance alongside Max, because I think he might be a big surprise. But that doesn't mean that I'm picking him. I'm hedging my bets here. I'm going for Leclerc and Lando, to be honest. That would be what the team I would like.
Okay. Well, good to know, EJ. I think couple of lighthearted ones just to wrap this up and take us into the beginning of this new year. You've just been in Dublin. We've got someone asking, what's your favourite pub? Who is it that was asking me that? It was
Phil.
I'm trying to find the... Where is the chap who asked that question?
So the problem is, Phil, if you keep looking there, David, why don't you put your glasses on? Are you too vain to put the glasses on?
Oh, yeah, help if I put my glasses on. Is that Phil or Chill?
No, chill is what you're doing at the moment. And Cyril is, okay. I think it's coming from Cyril. Which
do you own a pub in Dublin?
No, but I've paid enough money over the counter that I probably should own a pub in Dublin. But there are classics. customers would go mad if somebody came in and tried to paint the wall. They go, the friction, oh my God, why have you done that? You've destroyed the pub. The pub has to be the same as it was 75 years ago when they say, oh, Ronnie Drew used to come in here and this guy used to come in and that guy. But the reason why I like O'Donoghue's was that's where the Dubliner started. The Baggot Inn, it was different because the Baggot Inn was great for pints, but that's where Thin Lizzy came from, Van Morrison. All the guys started with maybe 50, 70, 80, 100 people in the bar all just drinking pints and listening to the music, whereas O'Donoghue's was very much folk, and that's where the Dubliners came from, Ronnie Drew and the history. And we talked about Shane McGowan over the last couple of weeks, but he was the difference. He was not a great singer, but he was a great, and I urge people, please download the words Sitting on Top of the World. That song is amazing because all those words that he said are so relevant to today, and it's a great set of lyrics. And so he goes down as a poet, just like a bit like Bobby Dylan. These guys are inspirations to all of us, and when we lose them, I think we'll have lost a major part of our life.
Yep, nice words, EJ. Fun fact, there's more pubs in Ireland per capita than any other country in the world. You're a land of the pub. And
why
the pub,
am I? Why am I not even remotely surprised?
Right. We're wrapping up this episode. It's been absolutely wonderful. That's it for today. Thank you to all our listeners for joining us. And we'll, of course, be back next week. And remember to follow Formula for Success on Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can find us on social media with the handle at F1 for Success. Well, EJ, it's a happy new year for me. And I'll leave it to you to wish all our listeners, our anchors, the very same.
2024 is going to be huge in motor racing, but it's going to be huge for so many different people. We wish them every success. And DC, we've got lots and lots of new talent and lots of big celebrities to come on board. And we'll have fun and recalling their interests in motorsport and motor racing, Formula One, or any aspect of motor racing. And to our anchors, indeed, I concur with you. A mega, mega, mega new year to each and every one of them.